We shall turn now to the Word of God, to the chapter read in the book of Job, the chapter 14, where we have the third part, the third chapter that contains Job's response and his answer to Zophar, who has continued his accusations and his condemnation of Job. Last week in chapter 13, we gave consideration in particular to Job's faith, the remarkable faith that he put in God, whatever it pleased God to do with him. Job was confident that God was worthy of his trust, and he was able to say with that faith that could only say it, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Some of the most outstanding statements are made throughout the book of Job, as we shall note here and there. They are truly remarkable, and only spiritual knowledge and true genuine faith is capable of making some of these statements that Job makes. Now in this chapter 14, Job now is reflecting. He's put his confidence in God. Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. And he has told Zophar and the other friends, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. And he says he will go into God's presence, he will order his case before God, come what may, whatever may happen to him, he has confidence God will do that which is right with him. Now then, in the chapter 14, Job begins to reflect in the presence of God, and he begins to converse with God. He has always been wanting to do this and continue this same desire. But as we've already noted, it's constantly interrupted. Job wants to be alone with God. He wants to come to God. He wants to speak to God. He desires that God would speak to him and unfold some of the mystery as to why he is dealing with him as he does. And Job is perpetually tormented with these interfering brethren. They are determined that they are going to bring Job to see his sin. They will do everything. They will produce every argument. They will not cease until they have convinced Job to get down in the dust and before them and before God intimate he's been and is nothing short of a hypocrite. It is a solemn thing, and it's one of the lessons that I believe we're intended to learn from Job. How easily we can forget how dependent we are to persuade men of the truth, how dependent we are upon the work, the person, work, and activity of the Holy Spirit. We can get it into our heads if we've got the right arguments, if we've got the choicest texts, if we have sufficient knowledge, we will be able to convince men of what we believe they need to know. And that just did not work with Job. As we see, notice how Job, we've already looked at it in chapter 13, verse 5, "Oh, that ye would all together hold your peace." To put it into our language, Job was saying, "I just wish every one of you would keep quiet. I wish you would all just keep quiet and let me converse with God without interruption. In verse 13, he continues, hold your peace, let me alone, that I may speak, and let come in me what will. Let me talk with God and stop interfering. Stop constantly intruding into this conversation between myself and God. I am aware, I'm conscious that God is doing something with me. I want to know what it is. I don't want to know your opinions. I don't want to hear your opinions. I want to meet with God. And yet they insisted on interrupting. You come to chapter 15. You would think after what Job has said, would you please all keep quiet, that out of respect they would do that. But that doesn't happen. Chapter 15, then answered Eliphaz the Temanite and said, should a wise man utter vain knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Verse 4, yea, what an accusation. It seems it's getting worse the more they continue. Yea, thou castest off fear and restrainest prayer before God, or meditation before God. For thy mouth uttereth thine iniquity, and thou choosest the tongue of the crafty. Thine own mouth condemneth thee, and not I. That's Eliphaz said, Job, we're not condemning you, you're condemning yourself. Every time you open your mouth, you're condemning yourself. You are very brazen. You are very confident coming before God, and you've cast off the fear of God to talk the way you do. To them it appeared Job simply didn't know God and didn't know who he was appearing before. And so, though he has pled with them, please, all of you, be quiet. Please stop interrupting, interfering. Let me talk with God. Let God speak to me. They insisted, we will do the work of God. And they, we all know at the end of the book, they were condemned by God because they had not spoken the thing that was right concerning God. Now it's interesting that here in this chapter 14, Job reflects on his own humanity, who he is, this creature that is responsible before God and accountable to God. One of the profound statements that he makes here in chapter 14, he asks the question in verse 14, if a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. Now, Job is struggling in this verse 14. In the original, what he is referring to is warfare. Until this present warfare is ended, I will wait for whatever God purposes to do with me. I will wait until he has accomplished his purpose. And I am Job, as we can see clearly throughout the book, is in reality battling with the last enemies. It's a war with death, as it were, a war almost just to stay alive. He is brought so low. But then he says this, I will wait until my change come. It was as though he knew, well, whether I die or whether I live, I know God's not going to desert me and leave me in this situation. A change of some sort will come as God purposes it. And then verse 15, here's what he says. Thou shalt call, and I will answer thee. Why will God call? Why will Job answer? What is the call about? Thou shalt call, and I will answer, I will respond. Thou wilt have a desire to the work of thine hands. And Job isn't here merely referring to the fact of his creaturehood, that God would call him to account as his creature. He has created him for his glory, and now he is calling him after his life has been lived here in this world, calling him into his presence now to give an account as a creature responsible to God. I believe that Job is saying something far more profound here. Thou wilt have a desire to the work of thine hands. Later, Job will say that while he's mystified by what God is doing with him, he says, he knoweth the way that I take. And when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. And Job knows perfectly well, God is working with me. When he has completed his work, the work of purifying me as gold, putting me through these trials, in reality, he's making something of me. I am the work of his hands. All these trials and all these difficulties have a purpose behind them. It is to make me something I'm presently not. It is to prepare me for that home calling into his presence. God will have a desire to the work that he has completed in me. He will have sanctified me. He will have cleansed me through the furnace of affliction. He will have made me fit to be called into his presence, to see his own work, to see what he has produced in the life of one who is nothing less than a sinner, as we see in the early part of the chapter. It's very often, I'm sure some of you here have had the experience. I remember there was an elder back in Scotland, and I remember how people were speaking about him. He'd been a very useful elder for years in the church, highly regarded, highly respectable, very useful. And the last time I wasn't present, but I heard many refer to it. People were amazed just listening to him speak. And some were saying, that's the last time we will ever hear him. Because they said the very tone of his voice, his language, his expressions, they felt he was on the very verge of heaven. And they didn't believe he would be long left in this world. And just a short time after, he was taken away and removed from this scene of time. And you often will hear, we're living in such a hard, faithless generation, as it were. We don't even hear the expressions anymore that you used to hear among the godly. I fear the young are not learning from the example because it isn't there. And you would have heard some of the older generation, and they would, because they would observe the development of personal godliness and holiness, and less attachment to this world and the things of this world, as they grew ever more heavenly minded, they would often say, "He's getting ready for glory. She's getting ready for glory. The Lord is preparing them." They could see the evidence as though they were becoming more detached from this world and more drawn to the heavenly world. And that's what, you see, Job, I believe, has very particularly in mind here. Thou wilt have a desire to the work of thine hands. Job didn't consider himself to be very much, as we see. But he did believe, God is working with me. And when he's finished, then he's going to call me into his presence to see what he has done. Now here, Job says, "I will wait till my change, I will wait. I'm troubled, I'm here surrounded by difficulties, I'm in affliction, even my very friends, they are responsible for much of my trying, but I will wait, if it pleases God, I will wait upon him." Now, going back then to the chapter 13, where we notice Job saying to these friends, he desired that they would keep quiet, that they would leave him in peace. To understand the depths of Job's distress and anguish, we need to go to hear him speak of his own past experience over in the chapter 29. This is later on as the arguments come and go between them. Listen to Job. Just look at chapter 29, just for the sake of time, verse 9. What does Job say? "The princes refrained talking and laid their hand on their mouth." That was his past. The very princes, the governors, the rulers, in the presence of Job, they were silent. They laid their hands upon their mouths and they were quiet. Verse 10, "The nobles held their peace and their tongue cleaved to the roof of their mouth," and so on. And here's Job now. And these that he's asking, "Please refrain from further accusations," they simply refuse. Job appears to have lost respect. He's being humiliated in the very presence of these his friends. In the same chapter 29, verse 21, what does Job say? "Unto me men gave ear and waited and kept silence at my counsel. After my words, they spake not again, and my speech dropped upon them." Used to be, when I finished my discourse, or giving my counsel, that was the end. No one wanted to speak. I had the final word, as it were. How different it is in the beginning of this chapter 29, Job still speaking, verse 2, "Oh, that I were as in months past and in the days when God preserved me." And he's looking back and he's saying, there was a time I didn't have to ask men to be quiet. They automatically, out of reverence and respect, they were silent in my presence. When I spoke the final word, they were silent after. The very princes, the nobles, were silent. And yet here he is. This is a sore, sore affliction. And as we remember when we started to consider Satan's purpose, the devices that he used, he has taken up some of what would have been considered, those who would have been considered at the time, most godly men, worshippers of God. But the devil is using them as his tools to inflict tremendous wounds upon Job, to disturb him, to try him and trouble him and accuse him. Now here in this chapter 14, maybe Job is thinking, I've asked them now to be quiet. I've pled with them to leave me alone. And when he finishes in verse 22 of chapter 14, Job remembers the past. It used to be there was silence when I'd finished. Then answered Eliphaz. What a trial it must have been for Job. How very different life has become. How utterly different is Job's experience. But you see, Job is learning and God is doing a work and God is preparing him so that one day he will call him that he might have see his own work, what he has accomplished in the life of Job. So here in this chapter 14, Job is reflecting. What's God doing with me? Why is he doing it? And the exercise is a spiritual exercise that we would, when we understand what's going on, we would be of a mind like Job. Why don't you men keep quiet? Why don't you learn to be silent? And let God do his own work with Job. And let Job speak to God and God speak to him without all this interference. In the Psalm 30, we have the psalmist there, and he obviously had a similar experience to Job, as we shall see in the Psalm 30, verse 6. Listen to what the psalmist says. In my prosperity, I said, I shall never be moved. In my prosperity, Job had years of prosperity. And here's the psalmist saying, I was one who was prospering. I had my prosperity, my goodly portion. And I said, I shall never be moved. I was feeling very confident. I was so prosperous. I just couldn't see any way that I would lose everything, as it were. I just couldn't imagine, with all this prosperity, it just couldn't evaporate, it couldn't disappear, it couldn't come to an end. But it could. And this is what Job had to learn in that chapter 29 that we've already looked at. Listen to Job. The work of sanctification through affliction is going on. And Job is saying there in the chapter 29, my verse 18, then I said, I shall die in my nest and I shall multiply my days as the sand. Now it's a little different. In the original, as you may understand, what Job is saying is this, my prosperity is such that I shall die beside my nest. I shall die in comfort. My prosperity is such that I shall multiply my days. I will live longer than most. My prosperity means security. It means comfort. It means that I shall live beyond others because I've been so blessed. Verse 19, my root was spread out by the waters, and the dew lay all night upon my branch. My glory was fresh in me, and my bow was renewed in my hand, and so on. Now, what's Job doing? He's contrasting what he used to enjoy and now what he's experiencing. But there is a reason why he's reflecting in the book of Ecclesiastes. There you have some of the wisdom of Solomon brought before us in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 14. This is the advice of Solomon in the day of prosperity. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. Why? Because God also has set the one over against the other, to the end that man should find nothing after him. What is Solomon saying? In the day of prosperity, enjoy it. Be joyful. Acknowledge it is from the Lord. It's ordered by him. But then in the day of adversity, sit back and seriously and solemnly consider that God has set the one over against the other. He's in control and he sends both. He orders the day of prosperity, but in his wisdom he also orders the day of adversity. Why does he do that? So that men would consider their place before God, that to the end that man should find nothing after him. He must recognize God sends these different circumstances and situations that we might think differently. You know yourself that very often it is the circumstances in which we find ourselves, or particular circumstances at a particular time, that makes us, it actually compels us to think about things that we never thought about before coming into that situation. That's the fact of life. Whenever children are young, full of life, they do not think of old age and the infirmities of old age. When they're happy and joyful, when they've got everything provided for them, they don't think like someone in dire straits. They don't think, children here are not going to think like children away out in some of these war-torn countries where they can't have enough food, hardly to survive, where their homes are wrecked with war and so on. You think of all the different situations that men find themselves in. It is those situations that cause them to think about things that normally never engage their minds. And that's why God, you see, has to sober us up sometimes. And Job was saying, well, there was a time when I was prosperous and I didn't really think of what it is like or what it would be like to be where I am now. I just could never have imagined what it was like. I just didn't think it was necessary for God to deal with me this way. I thought that it was sufficient that God would send me prosperity. And I sought to serve God. And you see all the various things that Job, as a very powerful and very influential man, did for human society and the orphans, the widows and the needy, as we shall come to it. But here he is now in the day of adversity and he's considering. He's sitting down in the midst of his adversity. Now, what's this all about? And here's his conclusions. Man, you see the repetition of that expression. Verse 1, then verse 10, then verse 12, then verse 14. He's concentrating on man. Man that is born of a woman, there's where he begins. Man is born. God is never born. God is eternal. Man is born. He comes into this world. He has a beginning. And man that is born of a woman is a few days in comparison. God, 1,000 years are as a day with God, and a day is as 1,000 years. And here's man, Job's considering him, well, he's a few days and full of trouble. It's as though when Job thinks of man, he concludes he cannot escape trouble. He may prosper, but he's born not to prosper, but unto trouble. That's what he's born to. He may experience it, and he will experience it. He cometh forth like a flower and is cut down. He fleeth also as a shadow and continueth not. Man is not going to continue in this world. That's what Job recognizes. He's reflecting on this creature and his own condition, his own circumstances, and he recognizes this. God did not intend me. He did not purpose for me to continue in this world. Therefore, when he sent prosperity to me, I had a tendency to overlook the seriousness of that. I wasn't thinking, as perhaps I should have thought, of my latter end, that I am here only for a few days. And then Job goes on, verse 3. He reflects then on God's greatness in contrast to his frailty, his mortality. And what does he say? And dost thou open thine eyes upon such an one, and bringest me into judgment with thee? It's as though Job was saying, how can God, the great eternal God, deal with someone, look upon someone to make judgment upon someone apparently so insignificant? And then not only that, is he a mortal creature, a few days, born to experience trouble and so on. But Job recognizes God is dealing with a sinner. When you come to verse 15, thou wilt have a desire to the work of thine hands. Who is God working with? Who does he cast his eyes upon? Who is it that he shows an interest in? Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? Not one. And Job is probably here quoting some kind of a saying that would have been used in society, but nevertheless making the point. Who can bring a man that is born of a woman? Like the psalmist in Psalm 51, I was born in sin, shapen in iniquity. And God will have a desire to the work of his hands, the work that he has done, the work that he has produced in the life and in the experience of a poor, wretched sinner. You can see the high, elevated thoughts that Job is having. Little wonder when we wish these friends would keep quiet and stop distracting Job, stop interfering him. Let's listen to Job. Let's listen to the wisdom of Job as he speaks to God, as he reflects on God's amazing dealings with him. Then verse 5, seeing his days are determined, the number of his months are with thee. Thou hast appointed his bounds that he cannot pass. Not only has God set the bounds by way of constraining him, restricting him, but bounds means also protection for Job, and Job is here reflecting. I have set the bounds. He doesn't let me do as I like. I make my plans, sometimes they come to nothing because God has set the bounds. But them bounds are to protect me. Sometimes, you see, we don't like God setting bounds. We want our freedom, we want our liberty, we want to do our thing, and we think we know better. And here's Job saying, poor sinners, if God didn't set bounds, where would they end up? If God didn't set bounds for their good, where would they be? His days are determined, the number of his months. He's appointed his bounds that he cannot pass, and that is true as far as his life is concerned, but he has set bounds to protect his poor people for their own good. And sometimes the bounds are very restrictive. And we might be thinking to ourselves, I just wish I could do this. I wish I could go there. I wish I had more freedom for this. But God knows where to set the bounds and how to set them in his wisdom. And then verse 6, Job says, turn from him that he may rest, till he shall accomplish his enhiring his day. As though Job was conscious the power of God in his experience, and the power of God even in his affliction. And he's wishing that he could just have a little rest, a little respite. Job was human, you see. But at the same time, you can see his resignation. I will wait, because God knows what he's doing. And he will have a desire someday to the work of his hands, and he will look on me in glory, and what will he say? It is very good. God will be pleased with what he has done. When the child of God is brought home to glory into the presence of God, do you think that Christ will be disappointed? Do you think that God is going to lament? Oh, well, he didn't turn out as I hoped. She didn't turn out as I had planned. Not a bit of it. God will have a desire to the work of his hands. And Job is conscious this work is being done right now. Man dieth for the sake of time, verse 10. So different to the tree, it may be cut down, the roots left in the ground, it will start and grow. But Job says that's not the case with man. Man dieth, and he wasteth away. Yea, man giveth up the ghost, and where is he? He's not here anymore. He's gone from this scene of time. He giveth up the ghost. Man dieth. And as far as this world is concerned, that's the end. That's the end of his earthly life. He will achieve nothing more. He will not engage in any further activity. And that's why Jesus, of course, during his ministry, and encourages his disciples and us as well of the need. The night cometh when no man can work. We must work while it is day, for the night cometh when our work is over. And Job is conscious that will be the case with him. His work will be over for God, but God's work will be over with him. Man lieth down, verse 12, and riseth not till the heavens be no more. They shall not awake nor be raised out of their sleep. That will be the end of their existence in this world. But where will they be after that? God will call. God will call. And they will answer. Because God will have a desire to the work of his hands. Now, Job in verse 16, and I'm jumping a little for the sake of time. For now thou numberest my steps. Dost thou not watch over my sin? Job is conscious that one who has come into this world from the womb of his mother, it is impossible that that which is clean can come out of that which is unclean. So Job recognizes, I'm unclean. It's God dealing with a poor sinner, and he's numbering my very steps. Every step. Now, we might tend to think, when we read language like this in the scripture, well, it's intended to be illustrative. It's intended to illustrate some point or other. God really is just keeping an eye on us. No, that's not what Job was thinking. Thou numberest my steps. Imagine that. We know of God numbering the hairs on our head, but he also numbers our very steps. Even the children wouldn't be able to recall how many steps they took today. But God knows, numbers their very steps. Everywhere you and I have gone, every step, God was counting it. God was numbering it. However slow or fast or small or large, every step, Job is recognizing God is keeping a most detailed account of my life. A most detailed account. Would to God we were more aware of that. We forget it so very, very easily. And when we come to the Lord's house and the Lord's day, then we begin to think a little more religiously. Begin to concentrate our minds more on spiritual things and biblical truth. But there through the week, as we step here and as we step there and as we go about our business, Job is saying, God is keeping a very precise account of every step of my life. Every step of it. From childhood to teenage years, into manhood, womanhood, middle age, old age, every step. It's all detailed by God. And this is Job reflecting. Knowing that I am going to appear before God. When the books are opened, it will be a most detailed account. And then, verse 20, Job says, thou prevailest forever against him, and he passeth. Thou changest his countenance and sendest him away. Man cannot resist God. That's what Job's acknowledging. poor man, born of a woman, few days full of trouble, a poor sinner. God cannot be resisted. Job's recognizing this. And if he's put me in the furnace, I've got to wait. If he sent me these trials, I've got to be patient. Because no man has ever been able to resist God. He changes his countenance. God, yes, God is joyful over his people. But when the need arises, he chastises them. He chastens them. Just as Job recognizes, he changes his countenance as a parent will change their mother or father will change their countenance with a child, depending on how the child behaves. And the father will frown when he's not pleased with the child. And that frown is speaking. It's part of the language that the child, it's a communication that the child understands. The frown, I know my father is not pleased. I know my father's frown means I'm in trouble. On the other hand, the smile of the father means he's pleased. And you see, this is what Job is saying. God, when he frowns, has reason for it. When he smiles, he has good reason for it. Do we learn, as Job reflects, it is that he might learn? Do we so know God our Father that we understand his smile and we understand his frown? Our Father which art in heaven. What does that really mean? Does he frown like a father? Does he smile like a father? Does he express his joy like a father over his children? And at the same time, when it is necessary, does he frown as he instructs his children? That's what Job recognizes. And then he speaks of the fact that though man is so significant and God deals so wonderfully with him, yet the world can do without him. His sons come to honor, and he knoweth it not. And they are brought low, but he perceiveth it not of them. The next generation, he's gone. He doesn't know what will become of them one way or another because his time has been spent and God calls him into his presence and he leaves this world behind him to continue on under the control of God. And then in chapter 15, when Job is finished, maybe he thinks, that'll be the end of the conversation now. These men will remember when I used to speak before princes, before nobles. They were silent. They never answered me again. They never disputed what I said. And now everything he utters is disputed. Every time he opens his mouth, they condemn him for it. And yet Job is recognizing this is the day of adversity that God has sent to make me think. To make me think about matters I never thought about before. And God knows how to change our circumstances to make us think, to make us think more spiritually. God knows how to do it. But we shall leave it there. May the Lord bless his word.